You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 50. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today with me, special guest is Marty Bent. We are I always want to say live, because I think live, but we're in person.
We're live. We're both live right now.
We're both live. This will not be broadcast live, but in person at Bitblock Boom in Dallas, hanging out. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, dude. Yeah. Been a long time coming. We met here last year, didn't we?
Yeah. We met here last year and then tried to meet up in New York and...
Sorry about that.
No, that's not why I was saying that. I just... people's lives, you know, are busy and then like, you know, come in from out of state. Hey, can I drop in on you? Nah, it's just not really convenient, so...
I think I was down the shore that weekend or something.
You good? It was Memorial Day weekend. Like,
yeah.
How are you going to drop in on someone on a holiday? I want to talk about a few things, but like, kind of what's your, I've heard bits and pieces of it from your show. If anybody's listening to this and doesn't know you, you host, Tales from the Crypt and you have your, daily email newsletter, Marty's Bent, both great resources for Bitcoiners.
Subscribe.
Yeah. Subscribe to both of those right now if you're not already. I find it hard to believe that you're listening to this show and you don't listen to Tales from the Crypt, but, you know, there's people out there, whatever. So what's your background? What's your kind of origin story?
My background, it's been a long decade. So I'm 28. Bitcoin's a decade. I was a senior in high school when I found my passion for economics and... I was a senior in high school, just so happened to take an elective, an economics elective, and the world just so happened to be going to hell at that time. So it was a particularly prescient class to take at the time.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Yeah, not that I picked it because my friends were taking it and stuff like that, but had a really astute teacher. It was like, boys, I went to an all-boys school. I was like, gentlemen, you should be paying attention to this, and... So I went to college with like a sort of know your enemy mentality. Like we, in that class, we went through the TARP bill and he sort of explained what a bailout was and what had happened. And going through the TARP bill in particular was really eye-opening. Like, holy shit, this is not the way this problem should be solved and should not be this politicized. And yeah, so I went to college with know your enemy mentality, studied economics, was force-fed the Keynesian school for 4 years. But luckily... during college, I found Bitcoin. I forget exactly how I found it. I think the first time I saw it was like 2012. Definitely did not dive in then, but I think like early 2012 and then late 2012. I was still in college. I think I got more into it. It was like I was at that time interning at a managed futures fund, which is like a hedge fund that only invests in commodities traders. It's a long story. We were a fund of funds. So we were a managed futures fund that indexed other funds. So we indexed commodity trading advisors into a fund that investors could get exposure to in one fell swoop. Managed futures as an asset class in the financial world is used as a hedge, basically. So managed futures funds are fighting for like 2-5% of people's portfolios.
Okay.
And they are basically crash insurance. At least that's how they... market themselves. So the idea of assets that you would use to hedge in a crisis scenarios, working at a managed futures fund focuses on that also sort of helped me hyper focus in on Bitcoin and realize, this is like a hedge asset that you can use, like, or at least that's the investment thesis that a lot of people use. And
sure.
So I was working at the fund. I wound up working there for about a year and a half after college. And part of my job was to write commentaries weekly, monthly, quarterly, yearly. And part of that particular task entailed knowing what was going on in the market. So I had to basically read tea leaves from central banks, know about weather patterns in the middle of the country, and whether or not fungus was growing on coffee plants in Brazil. So it was like that period of my life in particular was very eye-opening because I was just forced to learn about the world. And
you're being serious about those specific things, aren't you?
Oh, yes. Dead serious.
That's
crazy. Like, coffee futures are very very reflexive to fungus in Brazil, depending on what bean market it is, Arabica.
Wow.
Or I forget the other one off the top of my head. Yeah, but it's like things that really a lot of people don't think about, like how do prices become what they are.
So I just read or listened to, is that Hayek? I don't remember. I'm going to make my, you know, I'm going to trigger all the Austrian economics guys. Anyways, but like, so I just went through and listened to the one where he goes through and explains like how prices are the best way to disseminate information through the market. So I'll put that in the show notes because I'll find the actual name and link to it. But yeah, so like the basic thought is like there's no way that a central authority can have access to all the information for all the things like what you're talking about, like, you know,
yes,
and accurately price them. And the best thing that we have is just like free markets because it changes incrementally at all these different steps. And by the time it gets to the end consumer, like has all those different things priced into it.
Exactly. Think of all the granular data that goes into it. Like you're talking about data of like an individual worker on a farm that's been paid by a farmer, literally physically seeing the fungus and then reporting it to the farmer. And then the information spreads from the farmers and then eventually hits the markets. And there's a lot of information and things happening, like crops not producing or crops dying and going defunct, that no one person or central entity can know as they're happening. And
right.
So the matriculation of that information throughout the supply chain creates the price.
Yeah. Right?
And then eventually ends up in the futures markets. And that's where the farmers and other big players tend to go to hedge that risk. So there's a lot that goes into it. And so that was my job. And beyond weather patterns in Brazil and fungus in Brazil, had to read the tea leaves of the central banks around the world, and that got tedious after 3 years, and it got very repetitive. And I think that's when I really started to critically question how money works in our economy, like how the Fed works, and the ill effects of that really started to come into my consciousness. Whole time I'd been reading about Bitcoin, and I think I started buying Bitcoin my senior year. I shouldn't be sharing this information, but whatever. I got in some skin in the game while I was learning, and I decided after a year and a half out of college working at the fund, I was like, this isn't for me. I was looking at, I loved everybody I worked with. Everybody was very kind. Dave Cavanaugh, the president of the fund, is one of the nicest dudes I've ever met in my life, but I need to be able to move around, and I was just stuck in a cube and was looking to where I would end up if I progressed up the ladder there. And I was like, I don't know if I want to do that. So I decided to leave and go learn about tech and coding in particular.
You didn't want to drill out the wall like on Office Space and just like push it over?
I did not have enough clout to do that at that point. So I decided to leave and to learn more about not how to code, but how code works. So I took a UX UI boot camp that came with a front-end development course as well. So that's how I got my feet wet. And the whole time, the impetus for me taking that class in particular is I want to learn how tech products are made so that I could eventually get a job in the tech sector, hopefully working on Bitcoin. So I moved to New York while that was after that boot camp. And since then, I've been putzing around. I was unemployed for a while. That's actually how the bent started. I was unemployed.
Okay.
Trying to transition from a hedge fund analyst to a product manager at a tech company is not the easiest transition. And a lot of the advice that I was getting from people I was going to meet while I was on the job hunt were like, you got to write, like prove that you can describe a product or something
that.
And I was unemployed for like a year, and I was getting like pretty hairy. I was like, my wit's end. I was thinking my wife was thinking me less of a man and stuff like that. And So I started the Bent June 8th, 2017. And that was just, it was actually a combination of things. Like, it was the beginning of the crazy bull market that we saw. And my parents had been in New York and we were having a conversation. I was like, what can I write about? Like, what can I do? And my dad was like, Bitcoin, you idiot. That's all you talk about. Like,
you won't shut up about this. So.
Been talking about it for 5 years. For 4 or 5 years, you should probably write about that. And that's, I was getting a deluge of text and DMs, like, what the hell is going on? Because I was that Bitcoin friend. And I was like, all right, maybe this is how I'll start writing. And so that's how it started. Like, the Bent started as a way for, one, me to prove that I could write about something, and then, two, to teach people that were asking me about Bitcoin. So I think I started out the list with 10 people, and that's how it started.
And how many is it now?
It's up to 4,000.
That's awesome.
Small and humble. It's, again, the Bent, that's the thing about writing every day, you'll come to find too. It's in, and I've never done like any marketing of the Bent. I don't do SEO or anything like that. It's all word of mouth. It's a very engaged, subscriber list, which I'm more proud of than bulk numbers.
Yeah.
And, but it's grown slowly but surely over time from 10 to 4,000 in 2 years. I'll take it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. So what is it like, what goes into making it, you know, like, do you have specific places that you go to look for all the information, or are you just like,
So another good thing about working at the fund and having to know about all this information is that I actually think I was one of the first, I don't know if I want to say if I was one of the first, but, definitely in my office, I was the first person to utilize Twitter to get market data and like market information. So I was creating finance lists on Twitter just to keep up with the markets and make sure I was on top of my game. And so that led to me like using TweetDeck a lot and curating. And so a lot of the information I get today for the Bent is based off of this Bitcoin list that I've been curating for like four or five years now. And,
nice.
So yeah, I just use that list as a sort of starting ground to link me out to information. And then, yeah, just whatever tickles my fancy when I wake up in the morning, and I'll just go through what I've liked or retweeted and point at something and be like, all right, I'll write about this today.
Yeah. And I appreciate it because I don't come from my financial background at all. So, you know, my degree was science related. So I took the obligatory government economics classes that are basically bullcrap, and but I didn't care because it had nothing to do with what I was going to school for. So it's just like, you know, regurgitate the information that they give you and for the test, and then move on with your life. And so, like, I kind of got red-pilled on like libertarianism and Bitcoin kind of around the same time. So I can't say like one necessarily led to the other, but they made sense together. And so it's kind of been since I got into Bitcoin, like trying to, I don't know if that's out of order or whatever, but like trying to start understanding the financial stuff. So I appreciate you put it in a way that makes it easier to understand.
I hope so. Sometimes I'm like worried that I'm just screaming into the abyss and people are like, what the fuck is this kid saying?
I think all of us kind of wonder that sometimes.
That's, I'm glad people are liking it. It's, again, it was something that was born out of necessity, and I'm very humbled by what it's become in the fact that people wake up and read my dumb thoughts every day. Again, it's humbling. It's weird. Yeah.
And so when did you start Tales from the Crypt?
Tales from the Crypt started September of 2017, so a few months after the Bent. And that was another, I sort of got forced into the podcast. I had no thoughts of starting a podcast until somebody made me start a podcast. And that was actually my first job out of unemployment, besides the Bent, was Barstool Sports. That's where I wound up working. And the way I got in there was my boss, Lewis Roberts. I saw that he was tweeting at Stoolies to buy Ethereum in like May of 2017. And I DM'd him and been like, you should not be giving financial advice to Stoolies, especially right, to buy Ethereum at like local highs. And we met up and had a great conversation and sort of talked about Bitcoin for an hour, hour and a half. And he's like, you should, like, Barstool's known for their podcast network. He's like, you should start a podcast. I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, you should start a podcast. Like, people need to know about this. And So Lou, actually, I got to give a lot of credit goes to Buddy Loveless on Twitter, Lewis Roberts. He bought my Zoom, he bought my mics, and basically forced me to start it because he wanted to learn. And so if you go back and listen to the first two episodes of Tales from the Crypt, Lewis and I did a history of Bitcoin series.
Oh, cool. And so how far did you go up to?
Right,
I guess whatever that would
right
be
past
at that
the
point.
Fork, right past the Bitcoin Cash fork. That's
okay,
when we
so
recorded. Okay, so
2X hadn't happened yet. Well, it never happened, but...
I think it might have happened. Yeah. I think it might have had happened at that point. I think it was like early October when we recorded those.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay. I'm not a sports ball guy. Like, what is Barstool?
I feel like
that's like a really dumb thing to say because I feel like everybody who is into sports...
No, if you're
like,
not in the northeast part of the country, Barstool is sort of exotic to a lot of people. Like, I've actually been reading Barstool since I was 2009. So Barstool... I actually have a lot of respect for the founder, Dave Portnoy. He's a great example of showing up to work every day and producing something day in and day out and over time building an audience, an engaged audience, an engaged brand. And so Barstool started, I believe, in 2004. Dave, he was from Boston. It was predominantly a Boston sports website up until then. Or excuse me, not up until then. At that point. And Dave would literally sit outside of the train station in Boston and hand out physical Barstool sports like papers. And it's just his thoughts on sports and betting and stuff like that. And it's actually a crazy story. After a couple of years of doing that and producing like physical paper every day, I believe it was for 2 years or 3 years. One of the people that had been reading that Barstool, the physical paper, moved to New York City. And couldn't get it anymore in Boston. And he just so happened to be the CTO of Business Insider. So he said, Dave, I miss your paper so much. I'm going to make you this website. Will you post it here? And so that's how like the online blog that is probably the main source of Barstool's popularity started. And then so slowly but surely he started posting on that. And I found Barstool in like 2009 when I was in high school. They added a Philly office, quote unquote, was remote writers, and so I started reading the Philly writers about and what they were saying about Philly sports, and that's where I'm from. And yeah, so Barstool is a crazy example of like Dave showed up, handed out papers every day, and took. Now he's a multi-millionaire because he basically just produced content day in and day out that people liked, and he had to like Bitcoiners like to talk about low time preference. He has very low time preference, and the fact that He wrote poor for like he was a poor writer for a long time, and then had, I don't want to say it's obviously not overnight success. Some people see it as overnight success, but there was a lot of grunt work that went into that.
Yeah, yeah. So you've been doing.
So sorry to interrupt. Yeah.
No,
so it's actually a big inspiration for what I do.
Yeah.
At the Bend in particular.
Yeah.
And then the podcast as well. I don't do it every day, but I like to get a consistent amount of content out.
Sure.
I think at least one or two a week.
I think it's a hard thing to like, people don't realize that it's difficult to, I mean, at least with the podcast I found, it's difficult sometimes to schedule people and get it out consistently. You have, not to say that it's not work. I mean, for sure it is, but like you have the benefit, I'd say, of like being in New York and being able to, you have access to a lot of people in person.
Yeah, it's huge. And I'm one of those freaks who likes to only do it in person. We've done a few remote. I don't like it as much just because like, it's just like an awkward conversation of mine because like, you're just talking over each other at some points. So there could be lag and whatever. And yeah, definitely being in New York is we're spoiled. We have a lot of great Bitcoiners in New York. Great Bitcoin community. Incredibly spoiled with developers in particular, being able to have access to people like James O'Byrne, John Newberry, Matt Corallo, the list goes on and on.
Yeah.
Is crazy. Like Bit Devs, actually haven't gone this month or last month. I'm sorry, Bit Devs, I've been away. But we are spoiled to have that meetup in particular as New Yorkers because it is one of the densest, no bullshit, here's what's going on in Bitcoin meetups I've ever been to, and it's a wealth of knowledge.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And so then Matt Odell jumped on with you when When was that? To start doing the rabbit hole recap?
September of last year. Coming up on a year here.
Almost a year, yeah.
No, and that was the thing. I wanted to put out consistent... Not that I pulled Matt in because I wanted to put out consistent content, but people were like, we want a weekly show. Like I need something to do the news. And I'm not just going to sit on a mic and read people the news and give my thoughts. It's a little narcissistic. So Matt, I had interviewed early in 2018. I believe it was like March or February. And just knew he was in New York. He's somebody I respect immensely in the space and who I've been following and learned a lot from since I got into Bitcoin. And he's been around Bitcoin Twitter forever. So I've just known him from Bitcoin Twitter. And it was a pleasure to meet him, to interview him early last year. And then when the thoughts for a Rabbit Hole Recap came up, he was like the obvious. He's in the city. We can do it in person. And it was just a no-brainer in my mind. I was very fortunate that he said yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I had him on the show back in May. But, you know, like you said, it's a different dynamic when you're in person. Right. Yeah. I mean, like this, that's why I like doing this. It's like why I love coming to the conferences and stuff and meeting people in real life. Because most of my stuff is remote. And it works. It functions. Like if you had tried to do that with something like 10, 20 years ago, it wouldn't have been possible. You know, you'd have had to have like a radio booth and like all this expensive equipment to, you know, so like we're blessed to live at this time with, you know, the internet and free podcasting tools and stuff, but it's still different being in person and like being able to, it's just a different dynamic. Of just
read inflection. You can read body language.
Yeah. It's yeah.
Big body language guy.
Yeah, for sure. It doesn't always translate to the audience, but yeah.
No, it's no, in person, like, again, it's selfish too. Like, I want to meet a lot of these people in person.
Right, right.
And I'm like, nah, you got to come meet me. You got to have a drink and I gotta shake your hand.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that brings me to a question I had. And this is something I've thought about and seen kickback on Twitter for certain people, for having certain people on their podcast. Like, do you ever get this? Like, you know, I don't think mine is necessarily big enough to like take the heat or anything, but I've had people on that I know that other people are like, oh, I can't believe you'd have that guy on your show or whatever. And like, how much, you know, I know Peter McCormack came under fire for this from some people. Like, you know, how much, I don't know what the word is for it, like responsibility or something, as podcasters, do you have for like fact checking something that someone says?
Fact checking. I mean, I don't fact check on the go.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other. As a host, I feel obliged. I don't feel obliged to like push, like I'll push back when something's like obviously wrong. I feel like more of a conduit for somebody to get their point of view across.
Yeah.
Right. And I try to push back when I can. I've been called out for not pushing back hard enough. But my like Ben Hunt in particular, Epsilon Theory. Is a good example of an episode that a lot of people were sort of pissed at me for because I didn't push back enough. But again, like I brought Ben on to get his point of view and have that point heard. I tried to push back as best possible, but it's like, all right, there's only so much I can do.
Yeah.
If you're not making content, go do it yourself if you didn't think I didn't interview the person the right way. But no, and with that being said, I am also open to criticism and will take it into consideration, but I don't feel obliged to feed the Twitter trolls, you know. Not that there's many. And the people who do get really up in arms about this type of stuff in particular, I have a lot of respect for them. But like, I also, like, you're not going to dictate my life. I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's something important for people to realize is, like, you can respect someone's opinion, you can like most of the stuff they put out and also disagree with them on things.
Yeah.
Like,
if you don't disagree with somebody on something, like, on if you agree 100% on every view with somebody, that's weird.
You're probably not being honest about it, or you don't know them well enough to know all their opinions on stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's going to be disagreement in the world.
What? Shocking. Okay, so something I know that you guys kind of talk about is like narratives and like condensing the Bitcoin pitch. Like, what is, and this is something I love, like Alex Hardy talks about this. It's not like he didn't come up with this, but it's something that he and I had talked about one time. It's like the like what is Bitcoin to you? Like, what is it to you personally? And then like, what is your pitch to people? That's a multi-part question. Whatever, take it whatever way you feel like it.
Bitcoin to me, you know, Matt and I were talking earlier with Bitcoin Sign Guy, and Bitcoin Sign Guy's incredible person, but also funny. And you just said, if you had to describe Bitcoin in one word, what would it be? And I said freedom. So if I had to describe it one word, it is freedom. And if you expound upon that, or I got to stop saying expound upon, if I elaborate on that, Bitcoin is a tool that enables freedom, the likes of which we haven't seen on this planet ever, I would argue. Like being able to take control of your wealth, like, and have extreme ownership of it, which Bitcoin enables, is a huge innovation and a huge step up for human civilization. So to me, yeah, if you want to break it down simply, it's a tool that enables freedom, the likes of which has not been seen on this planet. That's a good way to get people interested, like how? And when it comes to pitching people on Bitcoin, again, a lot of people say this, it depends on where they're coming from. So,
sure.
Depends what their views are, what their expertise are. If they're a tech person, a finance person, you attack it from different angles. My favorite pitch most recently, which has worked across the spectrum, is Bitcoin making the world as energy efficient as possible. So using mining in particular to cap flared gas and create efficiencies in oil and gas fields that are leaking noxious gas into the atmosphere, contributing to climate change,
right?
And,
killing all the polar bears.
So that's climate change obviously is a huge buzzword and a huge theme in the planet right now. You have 16-year-olds taking solar-powered boats across the ocean to expound upon. Expound again. Why is that word in my head? To pontificate about how we need to save the earth. And I think Bitcoin presents the most actionable way to do that right now. Like, if you want to, like, a lot of people, climate change in particular, is just screaming at politicians to print more money to spend it on something that'll fix the problem. And
right.
That doesn't make any sense to me. So Bitcoin presents an actionable thing that we can do today, like, to make, not in no way consume less energy, but make our energy consumption as efficient as possible and make sure we're not leaking as much gas in the atmosphere as we otherwise would be without capping that flare.
Yeah.
So I think we need to cap every flare in the world. That'll take time. But again, that pitch and explaining to people how Bitcoin can make us energy efficient, number one, and then number two, drive production of renewable energy sources, just because people are experimenting with them more because they're accessing this renewable energy in these disparately located places. So that has had a lot of people most recently. That's been my favorite pitch to give, is the Bitcoin energy efficiency pitch. And yeah, don't even touch money at that point, because like, people have so many preconceived notions about money and it could never work, it can never work. But if you present something actionable to actually reduce the boogeyman that is climate change, I think that it can help the environment is a sort of interesting perspective that people don't think about at all.
Yeah. Yeah, because everybody's only knows what they've heard from the news, which is that like, it takes as much energy as some countries or whatever bullcrap. Yeah, when you talk about freedom, I think of it for, and I was telling someone this the other day, like the use cases are different depending on where you live, right? Like here in the West, we're not as free as we'd like to be, right? But that doesn't mean that, like, we're definitely not the worst place.
No, definitely not.
And so, I think of places like Venezuela, like I look at Hong Kong right now and like the mess that's going on over there. And I just think that like that's, those people are using it or should be using it then for censorship resistance for whatever. So, And I look at the way that we're not there right now, but I could also see at some point the way that the and it shouldn't matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. Like, Bitcoin should be for you. And
yeah, that's what, I mean, Bitcoin's is used to politicize things, and politics seeps into Bitcoin discussion when people want to paint it in a bad light sometimes. But at the end of the day, yeah, Bitcoin doesn't know about politics. It's agnostic to it. It just produces blocks, and it will work for Republicans, Democrats, independents, socialists, communists. It'll allow them to transact on the network, and
yeah,
sound money is good for everybody. So
right, but I think it's kind of on that censorship resistance. Like, God forbid, like at some point, like you look at the way that a lot of these social media platforms and stuff censor people, and you look at the way that they even things that aren't illegal. You know, you have certain industries and stuff that have a really hard time having banking relationships and things like that. And I can see, hopefully it doesn't happen, but I it wouldn't be too far of a stretch to see that start happening with certain political parties or certain...
Oh, it is happening.
You know, religious groups or whatever. Yeah, yeah, I guess it does happen with political parties.
I mean,
way the IRS...
Well, you could, if you want to... Maybe, I mean, WikiLeaks definitely isn't a political party, but...
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Very political.
Political beliefs, for sure.
Gab, I mean, I interviewed Andrew Torba, and Gab, like, that's another boogeyman out there. Is like, Gab is like, oh, it's full of Nazis, and everybody on there is terrible. And it's true, there are terrible people on that platform. But after speaking with Andrew Torba, if you sit down with Andrew and you speak with him, he's a good dude. He's a family man. He's just wants the best for his family, and
yeah,
really believes in freedom, and very particularly the freedom of speech. And he's just standing up as somebody who's like, hey, this is a hard truth that we have to deal with. There's going to be terrible people on these platforms, but you create a slippery slope when you start demonetizing and deplatforming people. And that we're sliding down that slippery slope now. So Gab's like a perfect example. 8chan, I've never been on 8chan, but it seems that the most recent shootings were used to shut down their Cloudflare yeah. services and stuff like that, and they didn't actually end up even hosting the original post. It was hosted on Instagram first. So if you're gonna shut them down, why aren't you shutting Facebook and Instagram down too?
Right.
If that's where it starts, there's like a lot of logical inconsistencies that come into play when you start sliding down this slippery slope. And that's one thing you mentioned earlier, like, we're in the West, we're probably in the most free out of most people in the world. But with that being said, like, our founding fathers warned us, this is something you have to fight for every day. It doesn't happen. And like, you don't want to be the frogs boiling in water, slowly watching as your civil liberties get eroded away by things like the Patriot Act and allowing these quote unquote unfavorable websites and companies to be deplatformed. It's like the famous, first they came for blank, and I said nothing, and then
yeah,
it's that playing out in front of us, but people are cheering it on, in my
right.
opinion. Yeah.
You know, it's like, to me, it's like the, okay, so like the person who, you know, like single person has an affair with a married person, and the married person, you know, leaves their spouse for this person. I'm like looking at them like, why do you think that they won't leave you too in the future?
Right.
You know, and like, so that may be kind of a weird analogy to use there, but like, I think about that when people cheer on the censoring of others, and I'm just going, okay, but when will it be you? And
yeah.
and it's going to be somehow a different story when it's you.
Well, more particularly us as Bitcoiners, when will it be us?
Right.
We especially have to be vocal, and that's why I feel compelled to write the bent and keep writing it every day and keep putting out content, because somebody's got to fucking stand up for this shit. And,
yeah.
I think Bitcoiners know this very innately and feel driven. That's why you have your podcast, and Bitcoin is a part of this fight against this slippery slope into Orwellian digital panopticon that we're
yeah. Yeah.
turning into.
I love Did you see Clark's shirt last night? You met Clark Moody?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I love his shirt. It's Make Orwell Fiction Again. I love it.
It's, I mean, I don't want to sound alarmist, but people need to wake the f*** up, man. It's, and I'm not perfect either, like, but it's, again, if you don't fight for it, nobody will.
And right.
That's what more people have to realize. There's a lot of complacency. Complacency kills.
Yeah, it does. It's, nobody wants to admit that they've been duped. And nobody wants to do the work to figure out, okay, so what do we do now if you know, like, it's, you know, it's like the Matrix, you know, like, ignorance is bliss.
Right.
People just want to sit there and eat everything that tastes like chicken.
Right.
So, I don't know. It's, I have a hard time because sometimes I kind of go back and forth between wanting to shout at everyone around me, like, wake up, like, this is all bull crap, and, you know, like...
I mean,
and then just going like,
we're about to go there. Jeffrey Epstein was just murdered in prison after running a child pedophile ring that had clients like Bill Clinton and Prince Andrew and other very powerful people. He was pretty obviously murdered. I'm going to go out there on a limb and say it.
You're not on a limb, though.
In jail, in front of the whole world, and nothing will come from that. And
right.
That right there, there was literally a dude who had a pedophile island in the Virgin Islands, and it brought famous, powerful people there to rape children. And the world knows about that now. That dude was just murdered in prison, and nothing's going to happen. Like, yeah. Shit is f***ed up.
Yes. Yeah. But... I will say I was slightly encouraged that, like, nobody buys it.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. That's maybe this will be the thing that wakes people up. But, like, the government is going to try to brush it under the rug.
Oh, for sure.
And that's how you know things are broken.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm just saying, like, I was slightly encouraged because, and it, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's my Twitter bubble, but it feels like nobody's buying it.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I'm encouraged by that as well. Even older people in my family who think I'm a conspiracy nut were like, yeah, that dude was murdered and that shit's not cool.
No.
So, like, yeah, people, that one, they f***ed that up bad. Like,
yeah.
It was so overt.
I couldn't believe... the audacity, you know, it's like, and people had been calling it for like a month or, you know, like a week before.
I called it.
You know, it's like everybody was just like sitting around waiting for it to happen.
Right. It's, not sick. There's some sick fucking people in this world. And again, a lot of what they did was enabled by power that was acquired by being at the top of this system.
Yeah.
Which I would argue is enabled by a terrible monetary system. And Bitcoin, obviously, it's not going to... It fixes everything. Bitcoin fixes this. Like, it can curb power. Actually, I shouldn't say that. I'm not going to tie Bitcoin to that. That was a bad thought. That was a little bad tangent there. I'm sorry.
No, it's... Okay, so, like, because I'm not a utopian, right? Like, I think there are... I'm hopeful... And I think there are some great possibilities. I don't think, and Bitstein's going to deny me for saying this, but like, I don't think Bitcoin fixes everything. But looking to the future of like, okay, but realistically, it does help things. And so what do we do with the idea of, you know, rich and powerful people, things like this, like Epstein, like Clinton said, does Bitcoin affect this or not? Like getting away with horrible things.
Yeah, probably not. That was a bad joke I just tried to make there. Like, Bitcoin fixes everything as Michael Goldstein pointed out this morning in his incredible speech. Like, you want the truth when you're memeing this. So Bitcoin fixes this. When you use that, you want to make sure it's truthful. In this particular instance, probably not. But it'll certainly curb the ability of the expansion of that power, or that type of power, by not allowing these, like, the government to print money and
yeah.
fund them. Yeah, I'm hungover. I'm sorry. That was like...
You're good.
Didn't make any sense.
No, you're good. I am hopeful that it limits... Right, because so much of that, and for those people, is tied up in their... Their riches are tied up in their political positions and the money that comes from a fiat system. And I'm not... Again, we're not saying that it fixes everything, but hopefully it is less available.
Here's a good way to take this. Bitcoin is objective truth, and I think that's what drives us towards it and how you juxtapose it with this particular situation that we're talking about is people are thirsting for truth. I think that's what,
yes,
especially in the aftermath of the Jeffrey Epstein murder, people are like, what the hell? We'll never know the truth there. And that's the beauty of Bitcoin. You know the truth every 10 minutes and what's happening on the network. And you know that there's integrity in that. Like, we live in a world that lacks integrity, especially the people in power. And Bitcoin doesn't fix their actions, but it provides a solution, an integral solution that people can anchor to and know, hey, I know this is the objective truth for the last X blocks or whatever, you know? And it's, I mean, obviously you're not storing data in it and actual, like, facts, but, like,
right,
how the ledger, the state of the ledger at any given point in time is the truth of the ledger. So,
they're grinding.
Somebody's getting a frozen cocktail.
Yeah, they're grinding ice over at the bar. I'm going to wait a sec.
And he's even picking it up. Yeah, these aren't even picking that up.
Oh, maybe y'all can't hear that. Okay, whatever. No, we just sound like idiots now. you mentioned integrity, and we kind of talked earlier about. Sorry, I spaced out.
Happens.
We talked about recognizing that, like, nobody is without flaws, and, like, everybody has those points where you disagree with them on. I think those are kind of things that I, you know, for me personally, my faith background kind of, I feel like, primed me for that. Like, I didn't go into Bitcoin expecting anyone to be my hero, you know? And you, like, so you've kind of, I feel like in certain episodes, I feel you kind of start to reference it, like, this idea of Bitcoin as a religion.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that? Like, is it a religion? Is it not a religion? Is it?
No, I don't think so. It's definitely got a lot of parallels to religion,
yeah,
and how they start and how they spread. I guess you have to get into the definition of what is a religion. Are religions created with thoughts of the afterlife? I don't think Bitcoin has any of that, right?
No.
It is very, again, it has very,
but
I think it would fit into, like, a lot of religions and would be kosher.
Yeah, I think so I talked to Bitcoin Rabbi about this. Like, it is not, his take was that it was not its own religion, but it is consistent with a lot of religions.
Yes. Yes. It's consistent with the anti-usury and the shooing of the money changers at the temple that Jesus would love Bitcoin.
Table flip.
Yeah. Right. And it's crazy because there's so many, not only religion is just one aspect of our history or human history, where you have parables and stories that have been warning about the ills of money used in a certain way. And we live in a day and age where money is used very unethically and immorally.
Yeah.
These,
yeah,
religions, I would argue. And it provides that fairness and that it's ethical money in the eyes of religion, right? And then obviously there's a lot of zealots in Bitcoin and quote-unquote evangelists. We're probably considered evangelists,
yeah,
for our podcast,
yeah,
spreading the word. There's definitely parallels, but how does anything organic come to be. It probably has to, the way religion becomes popular and Bitcoin becomes popular is probably very similar things that need to happen along that road, that you have to spread the message, you have to convince people.
Yeah.
You have to have integrity and stand by it for a lot of time. Like Michael was saying this morning, it takes, you have to have low time preference when you're developing these messages and just keep repeating them. And eventually people will get them over time. And
yeah,
that happens with, like, that's what the apostles were doing when they were going around spreading the message. I don't want to compare us to the apostles at all.
No, no.
Evangelism. No. But like evangelism is definitely a thing. Yeah. There's like a ton of parallels, but no, it is not a religion.
Yeah. Okay. What's your Satoshi theory? Like, what's your most way out there?
I mean, the most way out there theory is the Satoshi's an AI from the future warning us about quantum computing. But I think it was Hal.
You think it was Hal?
I think he was part of the team at least. And I hope it was. I don't know. You will never know, hopefully. And I like to think it was Hal Finney. Had some insight and had his hands in the mix, if you will.
You think we'll be able to unfreeze him someday?
Maybe. I mean, I forget who I was talking about with this yesterday, but that's another theory, is like Hal invented Bitcoin foreseeing that it would gain value, so he could, and like put his, I forget who was telling me this. They said like Hal may have a brain wallet in his brain, and he created Bitcoin to create the incentive, or to create enough wealth to focus on cryogenic unfreezing and bringing back people. I can't explain that theory perfectly right now. Whoever told me that.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah. That he, so that then Bitcoin would create enough wealth that would make cryogenics a reality. Yeah. And like freezing and unfreezing. Of course, then you, like, does that process mess up having a brain wallet?
Right.
We'll
find out. Hal, if you're listening to this in the future, we were thinking about you.
Oh, man. So what's next for you? What's anything new coming down the pipeline? Well, you guys did I talked to Matt about this, but you guys did the update on the website, and that was very cool.
Yeah,
the dime bag and the...
Dimebag's fun, but I hand up here, things have stagnated a little bit at the website, but we plan on vamping them up in terms of like TFTC and the bent, not really, but more the website. We're going to work on more evergreen content. Like I would love to have articles of people like, what is Bitcoin? I can just point to them and be like, here, go to this. So we're going to work on that evergreen content, and then we're going to get more into video tutorials and really try to ramp up education in a way that you have content that you can point to when somebody asks you a question, be like, here, go to this, because podcasts, they're like an hour and a half long and they're free flowing and not really focused on one subject. So it's not like the best resource to be
and audio is not always the best medium conduit, to learn things that, like, I'm kind of one of those people, I've got to see it and I really kind of need to do it.
I'm as well. I'm a hands-on learner, visual learner.
Yeah.
And that's why it's actually pretty crazy as a visual learner that we're just getting into YouTube. But that's what we have planned. Again, we're just, it's all been very natural up to this point and sort of come together in a way I never would have foreseen. And I like to keep that mentality. Let me just let things come to me when they seem right, go after them. And this like seems like the next logical thing for us to do is get more evergreen content, do more shows, maybe some live events, and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm excited for the one this afternoon.
Yeah.
But you guys are doing did you already do this, or is it coming up, like a cold card walkthrough class kind of thing?
Yeah, I actually can't take credit for that.
Okay.
Matt is running that with Evan Kaloidis, who's created the Zeus wallet, the Lightning wallet for Android, I believe. And yeah, so they are leading the cold card demo I will be attending at Chaincode Labs on September 26th. It is sold out
right now, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but Matt and Evan, they're going to walk everybody through basically how to set up a cold card, how to create more entropy with dice rolls.
Oh, nice.
How to connect to Wasabi and do some coin joins. And yeah, so it's going to be a cool event. I'm excited to go. And yeah, it's more stuff like that we're trying to get into as well. In-person stuff's great.
Yeah, for sure.
Meeting in groups, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's I think a lot of people don't know this, but I have a full-time job as well. So, like, trying to do everything on top of that is it's daunting.
It is.
And it gets tiring.
Yeah.
But I try my best to put out as much as possible.
And you mentioned your wife earlier. Shout out to all the wives of Bitcoiners who put up with our, like, serial entrepreneurship and, like, picking up all these little projects that are far more work than, you know, financially what they come back to.
Yeah, shout out to my wife. She's been huge throughout this whole process. She's been extremely supportive and a bedrock for me personally, especially when I was unemployed for that extended period of time. It was a tough time, and she was awesome throughout it. So
that's cool, man.
Yeah.
All right, what else? You got anything else for people out there to...
I don't know. Just keep Bitcoining. Keep fighting the good fight. I think we're winning.
Yeah, I think it's... Sorry, I'm jumping on here, but...
No, I was just going to say,
That's what... I don't know. You said something earlier that made me think of this, like, doing something positive is what... part of why I latched onto Bitcoin so much is because... I think I had heard of Bitcoin and it kind of fell off for me, and then when I started diving into libertarianism, I actually kind of got depressed about, like, realizing how much, you know, how broken the world was and the political system and everything. And so, like, Bitcoin is something, instead of just complaining about something and lamenting how jacked up the world is, like, it's something positive we can do.
Yeah, it's actionable. You can do something with it, and that's the beauty of Bitcoin, right? And maybe this is what we can end on. Like, and I truly believe that. I want to write a book one day. I want to write Death of a Salesman for the Modern Age. I'm going to get into fiction. But I do believe we have, like, a bunch of Willy Lomans running around the world. People lost and dejected because of the economic situation coupled with tech advances and loss of jobs. And you have a lot of people walking around aimlessly who've gone their whole lives thinking the world works a certain way, thinking that they were going to retire with a pension and have the house and be able to live comfortably, and that American dream just isn't coming to fruition for most people. I think we can say that pretty confidently right now at this point. And though the economy might be quote unquote growing at a healthy rate, unemployment might be quote unquote low, and inflation might be quote unquote on target, these metrics really don't represent the underlying. They don't tell the true story, right? And the true story is you have a lot of people suffering, working paycheck to paycheck, feeling helpless, and a lot of them are turning to drugs and, unfortunately, suicide and bad habits and stuff like that. And a lot of people feel helpless. And again, like, Bitcoin provides a common mission we can all work on to fix those problems and make a better world for ourselves. And again, there's a bunch of Willy Lomans walking around aimlessly thinking that their whole life's been a lie and they've been screwed out of something they think they were owed. But again, like, Bitcoin is here to help fix that, and you can contribute to that. That is the beauty of it. Like, if you want that better world, if you are unsatisfied with the state of the world and the state of our politics and monetary system in particular, Bitcoin provides an actionable thing through which you can voice your opinion and exit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I couldn't say it any better.
That's it. Yeah.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure. I'm glad we got to finally do this.
Yes. Agreed. Yeah.
All right. That's going to do it for today's episode. Thanks for listening, guys. And if you guys missed BitBlock Boom, you really missed out. That was a lot of fun up in Dallas. Big thanks to Gary Leland for putting that on and getting great speakers. And I'll put a link in the show notes if you guys missed Bitstein's talk and are trying to figure out what everyone is so triggered over. I'll put a link. Gary put it up on YouTube. It's kind of just a great preview of what goes on at BitBlock Boom, and if you want to see the other talks He's got a link there where you can buy the access to the virtual pass to see all the other talks. And I think Brian Bishop transcribed a bunch of them. So maybe I'll put a link to his website too, where he's typed them all out. I don't even understand how he can type that fast and like not catch his keyboard on fire. He just live transcribes them and types it out as it's going. Anyway. Yeah. So you guys should, if you get the chance, go next year to BitBlock Boom and the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute dinner. Both of those were a lot of fun. And, there was other stuff that went on that weekend that was a lot of fun too. And I kind of have a feeling this is going to keep growing and there's going to be more and more events happening on either end of it, as it continues on. All right. Follow me on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. Share the episodes out with your friends. That's the best way to help me out on the show. If you want to help out financially, you can go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com/donate and there's various ways on there. You can go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com/kidsbook and buy Tuttle Twins books. Doesn't change the price, but I get a little percentage of that. And those are great books for liberty and Austrian economics and different concepts like that, presented at a very beginner level. So good for kids, good for people who have never been red-pilled on any of this stuff. And let's see what else. I am working on an update to my website, so you might notice some changes. Honestly, I think right now it's just the way it is functioning is not very conducive for people actually going there. And so I'm kind of working on that and trying to update the resources and give it a facelift. So we'll see how that goes. If you want to listen to the show ad-free, remember you can do that either through Patreon or you can go to ellencast.com and pay a few sats and listen to each episode individually ad-free. So go check that out. All right, until next time, from Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.
There.
You can do it, I don't care.